Today is June 20th, 2017, and this is episode number 416 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO, and Brian is out on vacation today, so all week long. So I roped in Bob Dr. Mac Levitis to help
me out today. Brian gets vacations?
Well, we're calling it vacation. It might actually be work release.
I was going to say, I've been writing columns for the Mac Observer for like 20 years, and nobody's ever sent me on vacation, but I'm not in management.
Yeah, well, and you also haven't been sent out on work release either.
No, in fact, they haven't sent me out to work very much lately. You know, they used to sometimes send me out in the field. But now they've gotten so big and they've gotten so many great reporters that live in the Bay Area that they rarely need me to go out and do reporting. So I just write columns.
And you do that very well.
Well, it's what I like to do. I like the short form because it makes me be concise. You know, knowing that I'm not writing a novel or a book or a whole chapter even makes me focus more. You know, I try to do a lot in 500 to 1,000 words every week.
I think that's awesome.
It's fun. It's a challenge. You know, it's a whole a lot of people, I think, would have trouble sitting down with a blank page once a week and coming up with something new and interesting and banging out 500 or 1,000 words because there's so many things that really require more words.
Yeah, seriously. I find it easier to write really long pieces than really short pieces.
Oh, absolutely. I would rather write a 2,000 or 5,000 word review than 500 or 1,000.
Oh, yeah.
That's really hard. I mean, to get your point across and the thing is, I know there's a lot of people who don't like to read really long things. You know, it's like a column at 500 to 800 or 1,000 words is digestible. And I noticed that at Mac Observer, we now have a little thing at the top that says how long it's going to take to read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I love that because, you know, for me, if I look at something and it says, you know, a 16-minute read, well, that's probably a rabbit hole I can't go down right now. But if it says 2 minutes, yeah, you know, okay.
Yep, I like that we added that in. I think it's great because it makes it easier for people to figure out, is this something that I want to read now, or do I need to wait till I get home or take
exactly.
a break, whatever.
Exactly. I don't want to read that on my phone in line at the grocery store.
Right.
If it's, you know, 7,000 words and it's going to take 15 minutes. But knowing before I start is really nice. And well, it also gives you an indication of how much depth there's going to be. You know, if you see that it's a 2-minute read, you figure it's just the salient points and that's it. Top line results, which a lot of times is all I care about, you know, so it helps me get through my daily reading faster.
You know, I have found that a lot of people really like having a short read so they get the key points that they need and then they can move on with whatever else is in their day. So
exactly.
I'm glad that feature's working out for you.
I like it. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it until just now, but yeah, because I hardly write long form stuff. I mean, for Mac Observer, I'm always writing long stuff elsewhere, like book chapters and I'm working on a course now. I'm going to do a course because I love teaching. And I think I got laid off from University of Texas. I was a teacher. I've been a teacher there for like 8 years. But my classes don't, you know, the problem is I teach like intro to Mac, intro to iPhone, intro to iPhone photography, things like that. And I think the problem is everyone knows how to do all the basic stuff already. There's no, you know, new users. Used to be those classes filled up really nicely, and now they've gotten kind of low attendance. And so I got a letter from them that said, "We're doing our fall schedule, and you're not on it."
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, well, but I love to teach, so I'm doing a course. I'm doing an online course, which is really better because I can teach what I want to teach rather than what they think I should teach.
Sure.
So
what's your online course going to be?
Working Smarter for Mac Users. It's based on the book of the same name.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, there's so much stuff in there. It's gonna come out in three parts because the book's in three parts. So I think the first part, I'm hoping to have the first part ready to launch August 1st. That's the plan. Cool. So I got a month.
Yeah, you've got a month.
Well, two thirds of the first segment are done. So I've only got one third of the lessons to shoot and edit. I think I'm going to make it. Anyway, it gives me an opportunity to interact with people and, you know, teach way more people than I'll ever be able to teach at UT. At sure. UT, my average class was, you know, 12 people because they're 3 hours and they start at 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. And there's horrible traffic in Austin. I don't know if you've been here lately, but we somehow inherited Los Angeles's traffic.
Yeah, well, I think what happened was L.A. traffic got so bad, it's just spilling over into Austin now.
I moved here, and the traffic followed me.
So this is all your fault.
Probably. And I used to tell my friends, oh, you know, I love Austin. I can go downtown anytime I want at 8:30 in the morning, and it takes 22 minutes to drive 22 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Now it takes a good hour any time of day if I'm lucky.
Yeah, that kind of sucks.
Well, people come for South By and they go, you want to have lunch? I go, only if you want to drive up to North Austin, because I'm not coming downtown during South By Southwest. Thank you.
Well, I don't think you actually feasibly could. You already have to be down there.
Well, you can, but then if you want to leave your car somewhere, you're going to have to pay $20 or $30 for parking. And, of course, the streets are completely congested with people. And cars, because people come here and think that it's okay to walk in the street during South by Southwest. It's just incredibly difficult to get around. I don't know that people that live here like it too much, other than the lovely tourism boost it brings. You know, it brings lots of people and revenue, but brings lots of traffic. And
yeah, I think that's kind of common all kinds of places. For example, living here in Boulder, we have Boulder Boulder, you know, which is the huge race, and we have several other big events every year where major parts of the downtown area are pretty much just shut down. And people that live here, a lot of times it just gets so angry and upset because of what it does to traffic, and there's so many more people here. And
well, the smart play is that you rent out your house to Airbnb during those weekends to somebody that wants to be there, mm-hmm. and you charge a premium, and then you go on vacation somewhere where there's not a lot of traffic.
That's brilliant.
I told my wife we're going to do that next year for ACL Fest.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, rent out the house and the car. You can take the car. Go drive downtown into traffic. We're going to be out of town. We don't care.
I think this is fantastic. All right, so now I know where I can stay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's a big house, too. I mean, with the kids gone. Well, we'll be gone, too, so there's at least 3 bedrooms and several couches. You could really bring the whole team. You could bring everyone from the Boulder office.
That's fantastic. All right, party at Bob's. I'm putting it on my calendar right now.
I'm having a party here on the 2nd also, July 2nd.
Oh, I wish I was down there.
Brian's coming.
Yeah, see, another reason why I wish I was down there.
Yeah.
All right, well, give Brian a hug for me.
I will.
And hold him just a little bit too long so it's slightly uncomfortable and awkward.
Can do.
Awesome.
And I'll be sure and tell him it was from you after.
Oh, yes. Yes,
after please. After I've made him uncomfortable. Okay.
Yes.
Done.
Yeah. Hey, there's other stuff I want to talk about with you today.
Well, there's lots to talk about, isn't there?
No. I think all we right. should talk about malware.
Next, malware. Okay, because I just wrote a column about malware.
What a coincidence.
Gee.
Yeah, and I've noticed that that concerns about malware have been on the rise lately, not just for Windows users, but for Mac users too. So what's your take, Bob?
Well, you can read my column, which will be posted later today, I believe. Mm-hmm. But my basic premise is, I've not used virus protection or malware protection. I don't think I've used it at all under Mac OS X. So it's been a decade since I've used it. And I have not. I just hate running that crap on my machine. And I won't unless I have to, and I don't feel I have to at this point. And the reason I don't indulge in dangerous behavior. I don't download a lot of pirated stuff. I don't download any pirated stuff. No media, no apps. I've got Gatekeeper set to not let me run stuff that's not signed, and that's you know, and if I run an unsigned app, I know where it came from, and I'm doing it on purpose.
Sure.
I don't type my administrator password without thinking about why I'm typing it. And I've never had anything. I've never even gotten any of this, like, adware, malware stuff that you get from websites by clicking the wrong link.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty easy to get. But that stuff I don't consider really malware. That's just obnoxious ware.
Yeah, it's annoying wear.
That's annoying sure. wear, yeah. But you know, the difference is, and I point this out in the column, worms, Trojan horses, viruses, what do they call it when they encrypt your thing? Ransomware. That is malware. Other stuff is crap. It's just, you know, it's annoyance wear. But what was funny was the study that came out last week that the media has been quoting, you know, pretty regularly all around the web, says that Mac malware is on the rise. In fact, I think our headline might have said that. But
yes, and then it also said, but it's even worse for Windows.
Oh, yeah, it's way worse, but that's not the point. The point is, if you look at the detail, now here's the thing. It's an 80-page report. There's one page with Mac, the word Mac on it. There's actually a few, but the other ones are Mac addresses. So there's only one page that refers to the Mac. And the other thing on the page says, and I'll quote, hold on, I've got a copy of it right here. I'll give you a preview from the next column. Here we go.
Okay.
It says, and I quote, during the past three quarters, new Mac OS malware has been boosted by a glut of adware. So I can't prove this, but my feeling is that while we're seeing these headlines that say there's more malware, the majority of it is adware and annoyanceware that isn't really malware. I mean, yeah, you got it and you didn't really ask for it, but it can be removed easily and it doesn't do any.
It's not like stealing your personal data. It's not encrypting your hard drive. It's not crashing turning your computer into a bot.
Might slow your web browser down a little or something, but you know, it's not major and it's pretty easily fixed. You throw away a plugin, you throw away a couple of files. Not a huge deal. And like I said, I still haven't gotten any of those. Oh, I did actually. At some point. Now that I think about it, well, no, my default browser started becoming default search started becoming Yahoo for no reason. And I guess I clicked something somewhere and I finally found it. It was some little plugin that wasn't showing up in the toolbar but was active. Very weird.
Huh. Very weird.
Yeah. So I did get something, but like I said, it took me 2 minutes to search the internet, find out what it was, and throw away the files, reboot, and I'm done. I don't think I need to run software that constantly scans my hard disk and incoming traffic and things like that to, you know, protect me from the one thing that's happened in 10 years or 20 years even.
You know, in contrast, I've been running malware checking apps on my Mac for a few years, and having something on my Mac regularly is still, I would consider, kind of a new thing for me, since I went from the beginning of Mac OS all the way up until, what, like 2 years ago, before I was consistently running any sort of malware detection.
But do you run stuff that runs in the background all the time, or do you run a app that checks and then goes away and it doesn't bother you till the next time you ask it to check?
What I'm doing is running, well, I'm using Avira. So I have it set up so that it checks only at preset intervals.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, doing the thing where it's just checking everything all the time. No, for what I'm doing, that's really overkill.
Has it found anything?
Yes, it has. And it's found stuff that is in emails. And oftentimes it's spam emails, but it's still finding things there. And occasionally it'll find an oddly malformed cookie from a site. But it's not like it's finding anything that so far has been like
really malicious.
Yeah. And that's great. But
see, so I run malware bites every few months, just to make sure mm-hmm. that nothing snuck in. I mean, you know, I think I'd notice if something started to misbehave, but just in case, every few months I'll run malware bites because it's free, and I got another free scanner I run. And you know what? Drive Genius just put in some malware scanning that I'll try. You know, it's an on demand. You press the button, it scans, and it's done. It's not running in the background. See, and somebody asked me why I like Drive Genius running in the background. And I said, that's looking out for something completely different. That's looking out for damaged directories on hard disks and things like that, that if left unchecked are going to cause me downtime and mm-hmm. heartache. And if it can detect that before it happens so I can fix it and not have the downtime, I will run that in the background until they pry the Mac out of my cold, dead fingers. You know, that to me is an important thing to have going, and I've noticed no ill effect running that in the background. It's not like it's hitting the disk all the time. It just monitors and quietly, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I have 7 disks online most of the time, or 8. Mm-hmm. So it's checking a lot of disks for directory damage. I don't have time to go run disk first aid on them all the time. And I don't want to have to wait till I try to open a file and it tells me the file's damaged or something. So yeah, that
definitely sucks.
I just wrote a column a couple of weeks ago about how much I think, you know, that's one of those things that I just don't want to operate a Mac without that running in the background to make sure that my disks aren't degrading without my knowledge and that they haven't got damage that's going to end up causing me, you know, much more trouble than running the repair function.
Sure. But the other side of that is, even if something does go wrong, you run like the ultimate backup routine.
Well, that's the end of my my thing is, and by the way, as most of you know, I'm obsessive about redundant backups. So, yeah, there's mm-hmm. like 5 backups. I've got backups that run all day long. I've got a Time Machine running to 2 destinations. Mm-hmm. I clone nightly, and I do folder backups of stuff that's important regularly throughout the day. They mm-hmm. go to multiple destinations, and I have Backblaze. I've got a complete set of my data, including all my photos and music, in the cloud, mm-hmm. just in case. And I've got another copy. I've got one of those docs from OWC.
The one where you just stack drives into it?
You just drop a raw drive in it. And what I do is I back up everything about every 4 months and take the disks. It takes 3-4 terabyte disks to the bank and put them in my safe deposit box.
Yeah. See, I thought up until I had experienced what your backup routine is that I was like over the top, but
you're not over the top. Well, here's the thing. If you've lost data, and I always say there's only 2 kinds of Mac users, those who are going to lose data and those who have lost data. Mm-hmm. Because once it happens, you do what you have to do to prevent downtime or prevent, you know, a catastrophe from ruining your life or even just ruining your day.
Oh, sure.
Like the way I got things set up, I can be back to work in 15 minutes. If my Mac blows up, I can go to the bank and get a copy of my boot drive. And all of what I'm doing, like currently, lives in Dropbox. So it's already in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I need is a Mac and a way to connect the one of the hard disks. And I've got a clone disk here. If my Mac frizzled out, I could grab the clone disk and go to the iMac my wife uses and finish my work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I to me, time is money. If something bad happened and I had to buy a new Mac, download all my stuff from Backblaze, which would take about 7 years.
Right.
You know, if anything like that were to occur, I'd be out of business. So, you know, my backup setup is optimized to reduce downtime to a minimum. If I've got work mm-hmm. to do, I don't have time to deal with a crashed hard disk or a Mac that won't start up today. You know, somebody's waiting for me to finish some kind of work. I can't call them up and say, hey, the hard disk is down. I'll have it in a few days. I mean, that's just not how it works.
No, that's not how it flies.
So I, you know, after a couple of experiences early on with floppy disks, mm-hmm. I decided that three copies isn't enough even. You know, I want four of everything, with at least one of them in the cloud and another one in a location other than my house.
See, and that right there, that's a key thing a lot of people totally miss.
Well, if everything is in one room and that room gets destroyed, what do you got?
You don't have a backup, that's for sure.
I have two backups in my office, and I wouldn't have any of them. But that's the reason for the redundancies offsite and in the cloud.
Yep. I think offsite is a critical part of a backup routine.
Well, and the cloud, you know, you can have them send it to you on a hard disk. You can, mm-hmm. I guess, give them a deposit or buy a hard disk and have them send it to you. So rather than waiting 6 weeks for it to download, you could probably do it in a day or two. But it would be pricey. You know, that's not going to be cheap.
Yeah, but if you need it, you need it.
Well, if you need it, spend the money up front and do stuff like I do. I also use Drobos. So everything is kind of backed up against any of those eight disks failing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got two four-bay Drobos, but if one of the disks in them goes out, I just get a new disk, slap it in there, and they heal themselves, and I'm good to go, which is nice. You know, it's like I almost feel like that's an extra layer of redundancy.
I agree. Yeah, I have one Drobo, not two, and I did have a drive fail in it, and it was as simple as I popped the bad drive out, put the new drive in.
Waited about a day or half a day, depending on how much data you have, and yeah, all better.
It was fine. It was darn close to magic.
It is.
Yeah. So, but the offsite thing, the way you do it, I really like that because what you have at the bank, that's a few days behind what's happening currently on your computer.
Yeah, but Dropbox and IMAP mail pretty much account for the overflow. Right. You know, it's like almost everything that I need is either in Dropbox or in an IMAP email that I can access from any of my devices from anywhere.
Right. So, but having that version that's a few days old, that can actually really come in handy at some point. Let's say that you get hit with some crazy malware and it happens since the last time you took your disks off to the bank.
Right.
So you go to the bank, restore everything from that. Now you're prior to the nasty malware state, everything else is on Dropbox and in your IMAP email, and you're back in business.
Correctamundo. Also, I'd like to mention, I'm not doing it right now, but I have in the past, CrashPlan lets you back up to a friend's computer. You can give your friend a hard disk.
I was doing that for a while, too.
You know, it's like one of those things, if you've got a friend that you don't mind swapping spit with, I mean data, right. It works.
Yeah, the reason I'm not doing that anymore is because the friend that I had partnered up with, they were consistently just turning their computer off.
No, it only works with people who run their Macs 24 hours a day.
Right.
And it does eat up some bandwidth, but I've got Backblaze, so does that. You know, it's like if you're going to back up to anything remote, you're going to chew up some bandwidth. Yep. I really like Backblaze. I pay for it. It's not like they give me free service, so I talk nice about them. I pay for it year in and year out because it works. It's it makes me feel good for like $50 a year to know that I've got, you know, I probably 5 terabytes of data up in the cloud that I can get back if something bad happens down here.
Yeah, that's nice peace of mind and cheap.
Yeah, 50 bucks a year is really not very much for unlimited storage. And, you know, the initial, I have a, my boot disk is about 500 gigabytes. So my initial backup of my home folder was weeks, a couple of weeks, because I don't have a very fast upstream link. Mm-hmm. I got like 10 up maybe or 5 up. But I can download like a blaze. I got 250 down. Why is it that we can't? I want fiber. You know, fiber is asymmetrical. You get 900 up and 900 down.
Well, from what I understand, I know, but from what I understand, there's no reason why, with the broadband we have today, we can't have equal up and down speeds. I think it's still a holdover from dial up,
or even closer to parity. I mean, it's like my plan is like 10 up and 250 down. It's like, why does there have to be such a disparity? You know, I could probably live with 200 up and 200 down and 50 up. Can I move some over? No.
Seriously.
It doesn't work that way.
No. And what I'm hoping is eventually we get enough people that totally get, you know, consumers that totally get it doesn't need to be this way. And we finally see it change.
Well, the last time I called my ISP and asked about it, they told me I could get, I think, 50 down, 50 up and 250 or 300 down.
But they're going to charge you a lot.
Yeah, that's business class. Yeah, you have to upgrade to the business class service, which was, you know, my bill's already too much because it's my cable bill. And my wife likes cable TV. I would be happy to get rid of cable completely. I can watch what I want on Netflix and Hulu.
Right. But I get why you keep it. I mean, it's
my wife likes it.
There you go. That's if it's something that makes your partner happy, then it's something you do. That's,
happy wife, happy life. The other thing is I don't really have an alternative here. I could get AT&T, but it's not fiber. And it's the same thing. It's like, you know, the prices aren't that different. The speeds are about the same, and it's still slow up, pretty fast down for 60 or 80 bucks a month. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have that. Those are my two providers. Now, you know, Google Fiber came to Austin, but for some reason, they haven't run the cable to my door yet.
Don't they know who you are?
They do. And in fact, I've made it very clear that I wanted my block. You know, they had all these block things where you went out and found people who would pay for fiber so that they could come do your block. I told them, I'll guarantee my whole neighborhood. They will all take cable. I mean, fiber, if you bring it. Because everybody up here is engineers and remote workers. And, you know, that we've got Samsung, we've got AMD. They're all tech workers. They would all be happy to get fast fiber. I mean, think about that. Download a movie in 10 seconds.
That would be a beautiful thing. Yeah. Download your latest operating system version in a couple seconds. And
upload your whole hard disk in like 15 minutes. So, you know, 500 gigabytes in 10 minutes. That would make offsite backup really sing and dance if we had really fast. Well, one can only hope.
Yeah. Well, what I'm hoping, as long as one is hoping, eventually people got totally wigged out about why we're paying so much money for text messages. And that eventually changed. And now text messages is just the flat fee or it's just included in your regular bill. And I'm hoping eventually we see the same thing with our bandwidth because
I wish. Yeah. See, the problem is with messages, there were workarounds. See, you could use your bandwidth to use an alternative to text messaging. You had, you know, AOL Instant Messenger in the earlier days, and then you had all these other things, Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp and WeChat and, you know, all these other ways to do text messages and multimedia messages. Mm-hmm. And finally, the carrier said, you know, if we don't want to lose all of that traffic, we need to do something about it. And that something was first to drop it to $5 or $10 a month flat for a fixed number, and then ultimately to either bundle it in or charge a very small amount for unlimited. But that was because they want that traffic. They want you in their system. They want you, you know, they don't want you to have another reason to switch providers. And that's the thing. It's kind of a pain in the ass to switch providers.
Yeah.
So if you can make it less unpalatable, people will stay. You know, it's like AT&T. They can say, yeah, well, it sucks less now. And you'll stay because it's so much harder.
Yeah.
Serious. It's like,
I laugh because it hurts.
I know. That's their marketing plan. I did finally change mobile carriers.
Oh, no kidding.
One too many times with AT&T gouging me. And you know, the last straw was I was grandfathered for unlimited data on my iPhone. And they announced that unlimited now means this. And it was like, you get 20 gigabytes, and after that, you'll be throttled. So it's like, I looked in the dictionary, and unlimited means exactly what you think it means. Unlimited.
Unless you work for AT&T.
Well, they took themselves to redefine. So I posted a message, and I said, I'm switching to another carrier because AT&T has taken it upon themselves to rewrite the English language. This is what unlimited now means. And I went to T-Mobile, and you know what? They're not bad. They're not great, but they're not bad, and they do a few things that are really pretty sweet. For example, I went to Germany earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And when I traveled in Europe with AT&T, it was always a question of how much my bill was going to be the next month, how badly I was going to get screwed if I used my own SIM, or how inconvenienced I would be by having to use another SIM, if I even could get my phone unlocked. It was just a lot of heartache to go out of the country with an iPhone from AT&T. And they locked you in ways that made it very costly. I called up T-Mobile before I left. I looked on their website, and I was pretty sure what it said was, I can use my telephone, data, and text messaging in Germany. The cellular data would be slower. It wouldn't be 4G.
Right.
It would be 3G. But it would be free and unmetered. So I could have as much as I wanted at 3G speed. And phone calls and text messages were the same as if I was in the USA. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable deal.
It's a lovely deal. You don't have to think about it. You know, if you use your phone when you're out and about, you're not going to get home and find out that checking your map in London costs $12.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and I'm not kidding. I had one bill. I went to San Francisco with one iPhone 1 or iPhone 2, one of those. And I was using, I was so happy. They said you can tether your phone to your iPhone to your Mac and use it as a cellular modem. And so I got a quote for, they told me it was like 1 cent a megabyte.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or $1 a megabyte, I don't know. So I went to the hotel and they wanted $10 a day for Wi-Fi. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just use my phone as a hotspot. Well, it turned out it was $1 a kilobyte.
Oh, my God.
I got home and I got a $700 bill for my mail, right?
Oh, man, that's insane.
And I complained and they did nothing. It's like, well, we're sorry. We told you, you know, you could go to the website and see that it wasn't kilobytes. So, yeah, but I called and they told me megabytes. I called because I couldn't find it on your stupid website.
Oh, that just sucks.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, that was a long time ago, and I stuck with them because I had the grandfathered unlimited data, which for a while there was kind of a holy grail for me because my family use a lot of data. They stream a lot of media. They use maps. They go out and shoot video and then send it to their friends and put it on Instagram. And you know, these are people whose phones are out of batteries at 3:00 in the afternoon. That's right. How much they're using. You know, wherever they are, they're using lots of data. So it was kind of important to me to have unlimited data. And as time has gone on, we've gotten to where I was okay with having a limited data plan. The way T-Mobile does it, they give you a deal on your high-speed data. Right. And if you use that all up, they don't charge you more. They just give you slower data for the rest of the month, which is fine with me because we have 10 gigs a month per person.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly none of us go over. You know, it's like that seems to be just about right for my whole family for what they do every month. And when they go over, they don't even notice it. I notice it, but they don't.
Yeah, of course. They don't notice it. It's always dad that gets hit.
Well, I notice it because I'm looking.
Right.
They're not looking on their phone to see, you know, if they've, and the alerts come to me. Said, you've used all of your data. You're now on, you're now over your limit and you're slowed down. But like I said, you know, AT&T, they committed the ultimate offense with me. They made me a promise and then changed the English language to get around it, you know?
Yeah, that's uncool.
Yeah, and it was really expensive. I mean, I was paying like $200 and some a month for four lines to AT&T.
Yeah, it would have been nice if they took care of you.
Yeah, so now I pay $120 a month to T-Mobile, and there's never any unexpected data or charges on my phone. You know, it's like I can go use it pretty much everywhere I go and anywhere I go. The only downside is I think probably AT&T and Verizon's coverage is better in in many places.
Mm-hmm.
But I travel a lot, and, you know, I've only been a few places where I was way worse off than people with T-Mobile. I mean, with Verizon or AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
A few places. But around Austin, they're the same. You know, it's like my calls get dropped in exactly the same places on T-Mobile as they got dropped when I had AT&T.
Yeah, which actually makes sense because they probably have their transmitters on the same towers.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, if some place is hard to reach with cell signal, it's hard to reach for everybody. You know,
right.
There's some valleys I drive through where I know I'm going to lose a call. But to drive from here to Dallas or Houston, I don't know that I noticed T-Mobile being any worse. You know, there's areas where I don't get coverage, but there were areas where I didn't get coverage with AT&T.
Yeah.
I suspect it's smaller markets, which I don't spend much time in. You know, it's like I don't go to very many small towns. I think probably there, when you get on the outskirts, the coverage for T-Mobile might fall off. The maps look pretty similar. I mean, if you go anywhere that's populated, it's not that much different.
Yeah.
And I'm 2 years now, so I recommend it wholeheartedly. It's $80 a month. I'm not giving AT&T.
Nice. all right, I'm going to totally change the subject on us because I've got you here. So I totally want your opinion because I know you are already messing around with the beta versions of macOS High Sierra because you and I, we're people that have to rush in where angels fear to tread when it comes to new operating systems.
Well, me even more than you because I've got to write a book about it. I don't really have the choice of not playing with it.
Right.
You're just doing it out of pure love. Now, that's not to say I probably wouldn't do it out of pure love, but I've had to spend a lot of time with it lately because I'm working on High Sierra for Dummies.
Mm-hmm.
So ask away.
All right. So I know what my experience was like when I upgraded my test Mac that was running Sierra to High Sierra. I'm curious, what was your experience like?
My experience. Well, see, before we talk about my experience, let's just say what we all were expecting, which was apocalypse. We're changing the underlying file system when we mm-hmm. install High Sierra.
Right. And so going from HFS plus, we're going to APFS.
APFS, Apple something filing system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I envisioned the worst and, you know, because formatting your disk with data on it seems like a risky venture.
Yeah, you think?
Well, yeah. But I have to say, my fears were totally unfounded, absolutely unfounded. It installed the same way as Sierra. I mean, it like took the same amount of time, maybe a little longer, but hardly even noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came back up running Apple filing, whatever system, APFS, I haven't noticed any difference. I've had no issues with the disk. No file system issues, no weirdness with the Finder or anything else. It's just, you know, it just works.
Yeah, I notice.
You'll hardly even notice. Yeah, you'll hardly even notice that you have a new streamlined high-performance file system running under the hood.
Yeah, I would go so far.
There's no visible indication. You know, you don't see anything on the screen that indicates that the whole way that your bits and bytes are being saved on the disk has changed.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say if you didn't know it had been done, you wouldn't know it had been done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It was, I don't think, stunningly any way, transparent.
Any way other than opening up Disk Utility and seeing, I don't think there's any way to just take someone's Mac and look at it and go, oh, yeah, you're running APFS.
I think you actually have to go
the
in
same.
And look.
It feels the same. Yeah, you'd have to go find it either in About This Mac and you know, the thing that you open from About This Mac that's got your system report. That probably says it. And I'm pretty sure Disk Utility says it also.
Right. Yeah, and that's... I was really very pleasantly surprised at how much of a non-issue it was to go from HFS Plus to APFS.
No problem at all. I only upgraded the one machine so far, but I'll be erasing it and restoring it and probably erasing it and restoring it at least once more. And at least one of those times I'm going to go back to HFS Plus and put my clone of my other hard disk on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can upgrade that again. So I'll be going through the process a couple more times, but I don't expect any trouble.
I would be surprised if you have any trouble. I mean, that's how smooth and flawless this has been.
I will be surprised, and I was dreading it, because even with all the backups, you don't want to have to like erase your hard disk and restore it from a backup. You're looking at a couple hours of wasted time there, and
mm-hmm.
you know, even a couple hours annoys the heck out of me.
No, I get it. And this is why I tested on a computer where if I lost all the data, whatever, then I've just lost all the data.
It's a spare.
Yeah.
And I think most of us have a machine around or an iDevice around that we use to load questionable builds of things on.
Yes. And
it's totally not connected to anything else. You know, it's not on the network. It's not using any of my other hard disks just in case.
Yep. So I have a sacrificial MacBook Air and a sacrificial iPad Mini.
Me, I have a sacrificial MacBook Air and a sacrificial iPhone SE
mm-hmm.
and a sacrificial iPad 4 Gen. I don't think I can install iOS 11 on that one.
I haven't looked yet. I know you can install it on the iPad Air. Off
then
the
maybe,
top of my head.
Maybe I can. I'll have to try that. One of these. See, here's the thing. The books that I'm doing this summer and fall are High Sierra for Dummies,
mm-hmm.
followed by iPhone for Dummies 11th edition, followed by iPad for Dummies 10th edition. So the iPad will be third, which means I'll get my deep dive education in that probably in August or maybe even September. Kind of depends on when Apple announces ship dates.
Yeah.
Everything changes when Apple says when something's going to ship. It's like when you're working on a book, you just take your best shot. We basically guess that Mac OS will be shipping sometime in early September, maybe October.
Yeah. My guess is the second half of September.
Which will be fine. The schedule we're on, I will have it done before that. And the way that Apple's betas have run the last few years, by the time they get to Golden Master, I feel pretty comfortable that whatever I've got in the book is going to be the same, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it looks like our timing will be okay. I always have to put these books on hold until Apple announces or until I see the Golden Master so that I can go through and make sure that nothing changed at the last minute. But usually, that's not the case. Usually the last few betas are exactly the same from a,
just an overall feature.
Well, yeah, as far as human interface stuff goes, stuff right. that you can see. And so, you know, my worry is that the screenshots will be different, you know, that I'll take a screenshot from an early beta and they'll change the whole look and feel of something in towards the end.
Which is totally possible.
Well, yeah. So we go through it, you know, one more time after Apple announces a ship date. Or we see a Golden Master release or a final candidate even. Mm-hmm. One or the other triggers the rush to put it on the presses.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I'm always amazed at, after having written a book myself, been part of several other book projects over the years, that any printed book actually ever happens.
It's
a crazy industry.
Well, the dummies people have learned over the years that the closer you get to releasing your book when the software is released, mm-hmm. the more copies you sell. I mean, that's basic everything.
Sure.
Because you get more months of selling and you get more people that didn't buy the other book and things like that. So they've optimized their production to do these books, the iPhone, iPad, and MacBook, in a manner that gets them on the shelf as close to ship date as possible. A long time ago, when I started in this business, I'd finish a book and it would be 4 months before it'd be out. You know, mm-hmm. it's like I'd sign off on my last edit and revision, and then it would be 4 months of production and stuff, and then they'd FedEx me a folder full of paper so I could proof the I think they call them Veloxes.
Uh-huh.
So I'd proof those and then send back red line corrections. And, you know, now the whole thing takes place in Microsoft Word. A lot of times a chapter can be revised and sent back to the typesetter in an hour and minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they book the time on the presses for a certain time. They know how long it takes to do the page layout. The thing that's nice about these books is they're books that are already done. So they've been like, Mac OS 10 for Dummies has now been tech edited 13 times.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, it's just double check the new features and put it back on press.
It's like everything else is really fine tuned over the years, because if I make a mistake or if I say something unclearly, I hear about it from readers and it gets fixed in the next edition.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, by the Mac OS 10 book is the 13th edition of Mac OS 10 for Dummies. So it's very tightened up. You know, I don't worry about describing things incorrectly or unclearly, because if I had, somebody would have already told me.
Right.
So it's kind of fun, but it also means that these books are a lot easier to get out on time than, say, a book I write from scratch. Working Smarter for Mac Users, for example, mm-hmm. that took me 4 months just to get mm-hmm. it, you know, just to do the writing. These books, I, you know, my revising time is probably a month, month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
A lot different.
Yeah. Hey, since
I've now got hard copy of Working Smarter for Mac Users. You can buy it at Amazon.com.
No kidding.
Yeah. Sweet.
Okay.
They're cool. Print on demand. Here's why you shouldn't buy one.
Okay.
The ebook is way better. The ebook is less expensive because of the cost of doing print on demand. The ebook, you can't click on a picture and make it bigger. I tried and tried and tried to figure out a way to do that in hard copy, but it just isn't happening.
Yeah, the technology just isn't quite there.
And there's another problem. I've got videos in the ebook. I could not get them to print. Hard as I tried.
Clearly, you need a bigger battery in your book.
I think so. So, anyway, Working Smarter for Mac Users is available for $19.99 everywhere at Amazon and iBooks and at my website, workingsmarterformacusers.com. And I guess it's $29.99 for the printed version. So don't buy one unless you're a Luddite or something.
You know, some people really like the idea of having little bookmark tabs sticking out of a physical book and highlighting things and writing their own notes in the margins.
I get it. Yep. And I'm one of them. And most of the time, I would prefer a printed book. But in the case of Working Smarter for Mac Users, it was designed from the start as an ebook. There's movies. There's zoom in on pictures. The pictures are all high resolution. It doesn't work as well printed. We did the best we could, and it took me over a month of fine-tuning the PDF that they print from, even get it to where I was okay with it. And I had to write a big, long paragraph of, hey, you can't watch this movie because this is a book. Here's the URL. You can go watch the movie there. But, I mean, it was real. I didn't want to do it. But I had two people asked me when they could order a hard copy. And I figure if two people wanted it, then there are people who want it.
Sure.
But I'm going to try to discourage people from buying it unless you really, you know, are that one Luddite that's got to have the yellow highlighter and dog-eared pages and things like that to be happy. Okay, you can buy one. But I can't, you know, I can't recommend it.
That's like one of the most awesome sales pitches for a book I've ever heard.
I'm making a commercial about that. I am, because I think I really want people to know how I feel about charging $29.99 for an inferior product. But I can't change the price. I mean, I could make it the same and then I'd lose a few bucks on each one.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a good business model.
No, I'm trying to run this like a business, and sadly, I'm the adult supervision.
I see where the problem comes in.
I got to be really careful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't buy Working Smarter for Mac Users in hard copy. It's a ripoff. Visit my website. And actually, if all goes well, I'll do a commercial, and you'll be able to see on YouTube all the reasons why you don't want to buy a paperback version.
All right, that's funny. We are getting close to out of time.
But isn't this a podcast?
I know.
So is there like a time clock? Do we have to end at 60 minutes on the nose?
We're going to end as close as we reasonably can to 60 minutes on the nose.
Well, that'll be something new for this podcast.
I know. But, you know, it's baby steps. But I think I already know the answer to this question, but I'm asking it anyhow. Are you finding any standout features in macOS High Sierra that you're really liking?
No. And interestingly, I've been writing the chapters about the Finder and Windows and preferences and things like that. And I have noticed very few changes. Very few cosmetic changes. I mean, I think I've noticed a couple of small things in system preference panes that weren't there in the last rendition, but no new apps, I don't think. No new features, no new things hanging out in the menu bar. If I gave you my MacBook Air and said, what operating system is it running? If I didn't have the picture up, you wouldn't know. You absolutely wouldn't be able to tell without going somewhere that says you're running Sierra or
High Sierra.
High Sierra. But like we said earlier, there are a lot of changes going on under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think probably I haven't gotten to web browsing yet, and I know that there's some changes in Safari for the better, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gotten there yet, but you know, I think there's some new stuff and messages that I haven't even looked at yet. So I may not have gotten to the parts that are different and better. I will say for a beta, it's been remarkably stable. I mean, I've been using it like all day long, writing chapters and taking screenshots and doing things. And I don't think I've crashed it yet. I don't think I've had any trouble with it.
It's been surprisingly stable for me.
I can't remember anything even forcing me to restart because I felt like it might be a good time. It's been running for days since I installed the second beta, which was like a week ago.
Yeah, the only problem I've been having with it, and it's because I intentionally tested this to see what would happen, I let the battery run down in my test computer completely, and it did not recover gracefully from that.
Huh.
But that was on beta 1. Maybe in beta 2, it handles that much better.
Interesting. I haven't... this one usually is plugged in while it's sitting on the workbench, but maybe I'll let it drain completely. That sounds like a fun experiment.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens.
I'm pulling the power out. We're going to let it die. See what happens. All right. Cool. All right, I'll let you know.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing how well your computer wakes up or not.
Yes, but so far, I've really seen very little that looks noticeably different or works noticeably different. You know, maybe when I get deeper into it, maybe when I start looking at Safari and mail and contacts and calendars and all the other stuff that I haven't gotten to yet. I'm hoping there's some, you know, new stuff in there, because otherwise, how am I going to convince people to buy a copy of this book?
Well, okay, so
it's Sierra for Dummies with the word high added to the cover.
Well, you'll have some stuff that you can talk about with Messages and Safari for sure,
right?
Because there's new features there, and a lot of the stuff in Safari, it's kind of under the hood ish, but it's still stuff that I'm pretty sure you're going to need to explain to your readers.
Absolutely, but I think I'm going to have a lot more work to do on the iPhone and iPad books, and especially the iPad book. Because if you haven't noticed, the way that you quit apps has changed, the way that you change apps has changed. There's a lot of things that aren't the way they used to be for the iPad.
Yep. Control Center is completely different now. We have a dock. We didn't have that before.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there's just that book is going to need a lot of new content.
Well, I'm glad that Apple made it easier for you on the High Sierra book, considering you have so much more to do on the iOS 11 book.
I have two more coming right after it that aren't going to be as easy. But I don't think that means High Sierra isn't going to be a good upgrade or a useful upgrade. And as always,
I think it's going to be a really good upgrade.
Don't upgrade to the 0.0 release. Just wait a few weeks. Listen to everybody else scream about what broke. And then when the 0.1 release or the 0.02 release or something comes out, then take the plunge. You know, the people that listen to this podcast are savvy enough to know if they want to install 13.0 when it comes out.
Yeah. Well, there's my a advice, reason why you and I sacrifice computers.
Well, yeah.
No one else does.
Well, and we have to upgrade on day one and live with it. Come hell or high water, even if, you know, your Wi-Fi dies when you upgrade, which happened a few versions back.
Yeah. And I remember doing an update on one of my iPhones a couple years ago, had to do it on day one as soon as it came out so I could talk about it, and it totally killed cellular connection. So I had an iPhone that was no longer a phone.
Well, the phone is the worst part of the iPhone anyway.
Yeah, until you can't use it at all, and then you suddenly realize how much you appreciated the part that did actually function.
The part that was a phone, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, we're out of time, so we need to wrap up.
And okay.
I love how we just kind of had this freeform thing going on here.
We had no outline, no schedule, no plan.
Nope, we had some things we thought we might want to talk about, and we just sat down and had a chat. So what I'm going to do next is play the little outro bumper and give people the usual outro so that it feels kind of like it's a regular show.
Well, anytime Brian's not around, you know who to call.
Oh, I know exactly who to call.
This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. I love when we get to just have our little freeform chats like this.
Was fun. Anytime.
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Our content is written by the good people at Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. That's all we have for this week. And hey, stay subscribed. Bob, thank you again for being here today. You, sir, rock.
Well, thank you again for having me, and you, sir, rock more.